us trampling on the stones. It's us down, down to the bone. Blood is thick, waters were known well. Cousins were kept apart, mothers were off memories. Fathers were not favorites on the farm, for he could do some harm. He could wreck the master scheme, for he, brothers, could dream. Your mama ain't no saint, your daddy died in a shallow stream, but your uncle Dr. King did have a dream, my brother. And what is your real excuse? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Why can't you study your lessons and stay in school? Free love and sex ain't nothing but a game. Don't never last, try hope. Take a chance on love, register to vote. Money ain't everything, but you could buy her a ring. Listen to little blackbird sing. Buy you a record of a yard bird with wings. Get into the swing of things, homeboy. Buy some tenderness,
homeboy, by Sunchi Ali. Welcome to the Coon Rhyme Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. And I'm in the studio with my co-hosts, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 1-800-893-9562. Now, this week on the Coon Rhyme Report, our topic is Skid Row and the African-American community. And I'm delighted to have with us in the studio Kamal from Streetwise LA, and also with Amos and Aston. And later on, we'll be joined by two other brothers, Muwalad Abdul Shahid and Muhammad Abdullah. So, welcome to the Coon Rhyme Report.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you introduce yourself and tell our listening audience about your organization?
Sure. I'm Kamal with Streetwise LA. I'm here with Aston and Amos. Basically, Streetwise LA was started as kind of a grassroots movement to kind of capture some of the struggles going on downtown and the life of homeless people, an in-depth look into the life of a homeless person. And so it kind of started a long time ago when Occupy LA was starting. And I had gotten in, I became kind of really intrigued by the idea of Occupy LA and by some of the things, some of the ideas that they were putting out there. And so Amos was hanging out over there as well. And so we got to know each other. And at that time, I was riding my bike pretty much religiously. And so I was seeing a lot of crazy stuff, just riding my bike from the west side to downtown and vice versa. And I thought, you know, maybe it would be a good idea if we could give Amos a camera and get, you know, his kind of perspective. It was just an idea I had. I didn't know what it was going to materialize into. And so kind of the rest is history. And we've been featured on KCRW. We had a clip recently that was taken for Vice Media, and they used it in one of their features. So it's just been a really cool, cool, interesting trip.
Okay. So Amos, tell us, introduce yourself and tell us how you got involved and what your part is in the organization.
Well, my name is Amos. I come from Chicago. So when I met Kamal, first when he gave me the camera at this time, he said, have fun. So when I started videoing things, I started noticing the security of people being mistreated by being homeless. They've been discriminatory towards them because they're carrying bags, sleeping in the park. So I noticed that more than me trying to have some fun out here in downtown L.A. And so I informed Kamal, and so Kamal, he said, well, film it and talk about it. So basically, it started off when he gave it to me to have fun and videotape stuff. Then it got into a point, to this point right now, that we were trying to that show someone that the humanitarian part or the injustice part of society. And that's blew up from there. And my thing is that I start filming my homeless life. So And that's basically, and I gave myself a name, which is Amos, a.k.a. Chicago, so I can try to make you identify with me, what I'm seeing and you seeing as I'm videotaping. Mm-hmm. So it's like I was just the video speaker behind something that you might see on the video camera. So I tried to explain that. Mm-hmm. So basically, I start out just for him, just the video guy.
Okay. How about you, Ash? How did you get involved?
I just got my camera last week. But back when Kamal was riding religiously, I was riding bikes a lot with Kamal back then, and came down to Occupy a few times with him. And then just over the years, we've been involved in a lot of the same chat groups, discussions, and I recently moved, well, not recently now, but I've been downtown Los Angeles for a while, and I find myself in a lot of the same discussion groups with Kamal, with other residents of downtown Los Angeles, and you get really differing opinions between two people that seem like they're bothered by the homeless population and another group that seems concerned and want them to be a part of the community because they are. And over those discussions, me and Kamal got into it a lot, and he thought that I might offer a different perspective than Amos does, who lives, you know, down on Skid Row, and I'm living one, two blocks outside of it, and it's still very much a part of our community and a concern within the community. Mm-hmm. So Kamal brought me in to discuss those things, and so I just joined them, and I look forward to bringing a different perspective.
Okay. Now, let me ask you this. The use as a video, you know, as a direct action tool in the community, seem to be important now when you're thinking about it with the Scott situation, the situation in Baltimore, the one in New York. Do you see this as important, too? And then you have to remember that one of the first community groups that started doing that was the original Black Panthers up in Oakland before they changed a lot of the rules. They used to follow the police around in video camera there. What are your comments on
I think it's changing the world, really. Everyone has a video camera in their pocket and can turn it on whenever they want. So, I mean, you can capture almost any instance that's coming up. So it's been a powerful tool in helping to expose a lot of injustices going on because it's so readily available. You know, I think that's the biggest asset is it, people can just pull it out whenever and have it on them at all times. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much what we're trying to do is have a camera on the scene at any time so that if something happens, you know, if something happens right now, I can call Amos and he can be there at moment's notice. You know, he's living on San Julian Street. So if something happens within that community, then I can have Amos there or tell him about what's going on. And the same with Aston. If there's a protest going on or something downtown going on, I can have Aston there too. And mm-hmm. if I can't make it, so.
How quick can you get it up?
Within an hour.
Within an hour.
Needs to be up that fast, yeah. You know, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we get into an in-depth discussion of Skid Row and the African-American community, I'd like to play a clip from two Skid Row residents.
Yes, sir.
I just want to make a comment. Since I came to the city of Los Angeles in 2007, and I asked a young lady when I got off the Greyhound bus station, where all the people hang out at? She said, down on Skid Row. And it was 2007 on June the 19th when I got off the bus. I never in my life, a city like Los Angeles, seen this many homeless people that down on Skid Row, living on the street, living on the sidewalk. And I got to myself, the things I was doing is just like them. And I thank God the Lord delivered me from drugs and alcohol, that I'm in a program that want to help you get a roof on your head and you can move on.
Yeah.
Right next door.
Yeah.
It's a lot of resource.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't want to reach out. But I'm here. I'm willing to help somebody. Thank Every day you. I'm talking to somebody. I'm yeah. willing.
What's your name?
Lloyd.
Lloyd. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Lloyd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Valerie. And I've heard of Skid Row, and I had, you know, my opinions about it. I would come through, but I would come shopping. But the apartment building that I was living in caught on fire, and I got referred here to the Union Rescue Mission. And I seen all type of things on the streets, and I said, well, Father, God, I'm sitting down here for a reason. Maybe it's to face my fear. But in this community, I didn't see anything but all positive things, regardless to what the habits may be. I've never seen so many people in one community that had so much faith mm-hmm. and trust in God. Mm-hmm. And it really opened my eyes, you know, until it was like I'm just a happy camper. You know, okay. Jesus didn't have no address. Like, Valerie.
Okay, yeah, Valerie. Yeah. Thank you for the comments.
I appreciate that, you know, and I've seen how the streets have been cleaned up since I've been here.
Okay, what are your thoughts on the homeless in the Skid Row community? Let's start off over here with Kamal going around.
Well, the Skid Row community has been around for, you know, 125 years now. It's not going to go away, you know, and I don't think it should. It has a very important history in Los Angeles. I think that we just need to approach it differently, really, is the key to it. You know, it started out as kind of, they opened a lot of residential hotels in the about the turn of the century. And so that brought a lot of, you know, transient people and then just your everyday worker that found affordable living there. So they made that their home. But eventually, you know, with all the resources that came about down there, there was a big homeless population that came in, and it's pretty much since I think about 1930 there was like about 10,000 people in the Skid Row area that were homeless or alcoholics or just kind of the society's margin or the forgotten. And so you know, it's been around for a long time, and that history's there. I think we just need to kind of look at it differently and approach it from a different way than we're doing it right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, we get down. But, you know, it's sort of what we got down there now is a recent phenomenon. Because when you look at, I remember when I was in the military in the Marines down here. And the first time I came to L.A. was in, I guess, 69, something like that, when I was going to boot camp. And when we would come to L.A., there was two hotels that most of the Marines and stuff stayed at, the Cecil Hotel and the Clark Hotel. But you didn't have the influx of people living down there, and then later on for a number of reasons. Most of the people lived in the, they had the 99-cent movies. They had about 10 99-cent movies that would open up at 12 noon, and it would run all the way up until 6 in the morning. And they would rotate. You still see most of the big movies, the Los Angeles and all these places up and down Main, Broadway and all that kind of stuff like that. That's what it was. Most of your homeless stayed there. Mm-hmm. See, and you didn't have that influx. And then the thing that really changed it, that began to change, is when they began to close down most of these movies and stuff. And then you had another a couple complex things that came together that really changed it. You had the crack cocaine epidemic and the prison industrial complex. See, that's what created the jam up there and changed. Because prior to that, you probably had 90% of it was white Europeans, probably guys that would be 50, 60, 70, the old wino concept that they talked about.
Sure.
But that changed and led us into the direction we're heading into now. What are your thoughts on Skid Row and the homeless community, what we're seeing happening down there now?
Well, I know it's been going on before I got here from Chicago. And I know where I come from, I've been in Cabrini Green, and it was a big drug epidemic and gangbanging epidemic down there.
Mm-hmm.
But here, that's a big drug epidemic and mental illness that I have witnessed and have been in. I don't per se, at the time when I was homeless, pitched my tent down on Skid Row. I pitched my tent in front of CCA, which was occupied by LA, occupied at that time. With people, I had noticed that they in they become enabled when people is bringing excess things to them. If I have someone to bring me clothes and food and I receive my GI check or my SSI check or my benefits, of course I'm going to get that to the drug man because I know every day someone is coming down there to feed me. But you got missions down there. You got people that's got signs that I'm hungry. Oh, okay, if you're hungry, all these missions down and people is bringing food. So the drug epidemic is people's, they wants to get high. You got to want to stop using drugs. You got to want to do better. If a person is getting to the point that's enabled, people is enabled them to the point that I don't have to work. I don't have to go out and pay rent. I don't have to do this and do that. Of course, that I'm going to sleep in a tent. You know, of course, I'm going to have my tent up all day. The tent, I don't think that rule of having the tent from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. was designed for you to keep your tent up all day, mm-hmm. sleep all day, and do nothing all day. My thing about, and now it's blown out of proportion, now you all of a sudden y'all got a problem. Well, the problem been there before I even got here, but I'm seeing it that it's just horrific, the drug mm-hmm. use, the mental mm-hmm. illness, the killing, and you know, it's not gangbangers to me down there, that's drug use. I noticed that people that's in the tent selling drugs, you know, and they probably have somewhere to live, but they come down here and use the homeless life to sell drugs to the people that's on drugs.
And then you have the mental illness too factor where mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. you know, need their medications, but a lot of times they'll come to Skid Row. They'll run out of their medications or lose their medications, et cetera. Then they'll turn to the drug dealers for, you know, way out, you know? Yeah, so yeah,
it's a problem of having all of that in the same place. You, mm-hmm. Like, this is where all the services are. You can go there to get food. You can go to the missions. But also, the dealers know that, all right, that's where people are going to go. So they're there, too. So it's really tough that you're offering the services in the same place that you're offering the dealers. And there's not really enough places to go out and get services. So now we've got this problem that we're going to call, like, you know, the problem of Skid Row. Right?
Yeah.
And it's more than just not one to get off of drugs. You need the services to get off of drugs.
Yeah, you need the services.
Right.
Exactly.
The service, like, there's services down there as far as food and housing, but there's not enough wraparound services. There's not enough individualized services. There's there's not enough just looking to help people out of that situation with more than just housing, addressing any trauma that they've been through and services mm-hmm. they need that way.
But you say that the people that want to stop you, well, the service is there. I went through Wyandotte, right. And I used the service for the mm-hmm. mission to get off the street. Mm-hmm. So the service is there. Now you got people that want to, and you got people that don't want to. That's be wholehearted, fat cold about it. Then you got some people that's pretty much probably mentally is incapable of trying to help themselves. Mm-hmm. So, and that's the problem. So them, what he's talking about, that individual in a one-on-one basis, and that's what you call, that's what people go out there and try to offer these, that mm-hmm. kind of recovering, interacting on the street.
Well, let me ask this then. Which one of the, when you're talking about, because I hear people talking about the drug dealers and all that kind of stuff in the Skid Row area.
Yes.
But how about the legal drug dealers? From what I see, right, the pharmaceutical companies, the fact that they take a little area like Skid Row, which is nothing but a level one facility, the same way that they would have in the joint when they had the halfway house and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And at these level one facilities where they have a controlled population, the pharmaceutical companies push synthetic, what do you call those drugs when they got another name for them?
Generic
drugs that they get free down there. So when I see the people wobbling and all like that, I don't see them wobbling from marijuana or from cocaine or crack. I see them wobbling from all these strong legal drugs.
Yes, you have people prescribing. That abuse that. Abuse the mental illness drug factor. Then you got people that would take the pain pill and don't actually take them and sell the pain pill and for the money to get their crystal or the crack cocaine or what we say their drug of choice. Now, mm-hmm. I'm a recovering addict, mm-hmm. and I take pain pills, but my pain pills is non-narcotics mm-hmm. pain pills. So there is a way out of that, mm-hmm. but some people that you might see that's on that type of self-medicated prescription legal drugs,
yeah,
is that they can't get it from the doctor. They buy from the people that get it, and they mm-hmm. sell it on
yeah.
the street.
And then, because from a lot of people that I talk to, especially a lot of veterans, it seemed the problem is that all of these prescribed drugs, when they prescribe more than one particular drug, and they really don't have an idea. They may know the side effects of one particular type of drug. But when they have a person on three and four, see, they still studying that. That's why they be studying a lot of that. And that's one element that we forgot when we was talking about the Skid Row area, is when Ronald Reagan yeah. let out the mentally ill. That really brought in, made it a complex situation down there. Why? So when you look at Skid Row, especially the ones that's living in the tent, African-American probably make up 9-something. They lucky we make up 10%. Let's say we make up 10% of the population of Los Angeles. Yet and still, we're about 85 or 90% of the ones living in the tents and on the street. Can you want to come and talk about that?
Yeah. Let me just yeah. say this, and I'm going to let them talk. Mm-hmm. You got to realize most people that's here in downtown L.A. and California is not from California. So they from different states around. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. And you got a lot of African American people that come from different states or that live here too, and probably got kicked out their neighborhood, family disown them, so they had to move around, and they heard so much, and they got a windfall of downtown LA. How you can sleep in the mission and sleep outside in the county of LA, so they're gonna utilize this. Instead of paying rent, or if you have an argument with your significant other, all right, I'm not going to pay rent. I'm sleeping in the tent. You mm-hmm. dig what I'm saying? So that's why I would think that way. Well, I don't have to pay no rent.
But the Hispanics, the Europeans, and the Asians, I mean, they're not going to the same. What I'm saying is how come we had this huge... You know, the whole human condition, what you just got through talking about, you know, the Hispanic go through it. They deal with that. The Europeans deal with that. The Asians deal with that. But yet and still, we got 85, 90% of the African. You want to say something?
I think you nailed it right at the top when you said it was the 80s with Ronald Reagan letting out the mental institutions, which that's not just us. But you had the crack epidemic and the crack minimums. Industrial prison complex.
Mm-hmm.
Once a week, at least, I'm talking to somebody who just got let out of jail. They don't have anything on them, and they're down in Skid Row because they just got put on the street with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That was geared towards the African-American community, and it's not just the people that went into jail that were affected by it. It's the people that were left behind, their family members.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That short period in the 70s and 80s pretty much broke the black community in a lot of ways, and I think that's why you still see so many black people out there. It's because... It's the carrying on of that system.
And then you got L.A. County, you know, that's right there that pretty much just feeds into Skid Row.
Correctly
into Skid Row. And because, you know, the complex with the jail mm-hmm. system, you're going to obviously get a huge population of African Americans on Skid Row as well. As soon as they're getting let out, they're going to go to their, you know, a place where it's cheap, where they can get whatever they want. They can get a meal. They can get anything they want.
And some of them be paroled down there, too, which is called the AB1 program. So mm-hmm. some of them, they be paroled and they got probation down there. Some of them is on the ankle braces. And some of the program, they don't have nowhere to stay, so they used the mission for the address, and they got the ankle braces there. And once they off the ankle braces or off parole or mm-hmm. off probation, they okay. didn't do nothing. So it's like you got to have some type of organization to direct those type of people that's coming out, which is... ex-convicts like myself.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
I was locked up in the penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I went to school up in there. They don't even have school in no more.
Mm-hmm.
My crime, when I first took cop, they could have let me go, but by me being an African-American at that time, when I caught my case, they weren't trying to let me go. They were trying to put me in jail and get a number on me.
Now, how much do you think it has to do with the fact that the African-American has no clear community where they control the economic life of their community. Because like right here in Los Angeles, our community, even the, let's say the, let's look at some of the distinct historical African-American communities here. We know Leimert Park, probably Inglewood, used to be Compton and Watts. See, and neither of those communities do you have African-Americans where you have a huge amount of business or any business that could create jobs. But everywhere else, you go to Koreatown, you go to the Hispanic community, you go to the Asian community, you go to all of these communities around here have a clearly defined economic community in which they control the whole economic life of their community. And yet and still, they also exist in the secondary community, which I call the shopping mall community, two communities. But the African American, we only exist in that secondary community. We spend money in that shopping mall community, but we don't own nothing in our own communities. And I think that got a lot to do with the fact that you see so many African American out of jobs. Even the ones that come out of the system need to be retrained, you know, because this is where I look. We're going to talk about that in a little while when we start talking about solutions, the obligation of the African-American leadership here in Los Angeles, especially the religious leadership should be at the forefront. You know, it's a shame when you got, it should be a shame on the African-American community here on what's happening in Skid Row. To have 85 and 90% African-American living in these tents. See, and that's acceptable. That's a shame on the ones that call themselves leadership or religious people here in Los Angeles. Because this is a homeless capital.
And I mean, you're just pointing to religious leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Dre just became a billionaire this year. Mm-hmm. He's from Compton.
Yeah.
You don't see enough presence of all sorts of people that probably should be deeper in the community than they are. It's not just religious leaders. Mm-hmm. There's people that could probably even today make a bigger difference because they've got a bigger name and they should be down there in the community. But even in things like, you know, and not just in Los Angeles, but Occupy and Ferguson and everything, you barely see all of these people. You know, you get people like Talib Kweli or J. Cole, they're out there. But all these people that are making a ton of money off the black community and spending this whole narrative of, you know, going out and balling and spending and all that stuff. You don't see them anywhere in the community when it comes to things like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's on more than just, you know, the religious leadership. We need to kind of put it on everyone. And I think that is a failure in the black community. It's a failure.
And but see, the reason the religious community have to be up at the forefront, because this is within the orbit of their religious doctrine. It's articulated right in there that they're supposed to be dealing with the homeless, the prisoners, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's at the top point of it. The whole concept dealing with the Messiah in the Bible had to do with taking care of those coming out of prison, those who are poor, and all that kind of stuff. Now, see, when I look at Dr. Dre, all these guys, the reason the obligation on them, they just regular capitalists. You know, they out after profit. They doing what they supposed to do.
That's true.
See, you know, if they could have some concern, if we're going to say that they supposed to do anything from a religious nature, they supposed to tithe, you know, give 10% or something like that. But the religious community, it is articulated that this is what they supposed to do because that's what they say that they are believers. They're Christian, Muslim. Jews, it's right there in their scripture. It's on them first. See, and
one could argue some of them are capitalists too, though. You know, there's the guy who's trying to get his plane bought by his
religious
leader.
They're motivated by
money, for sure. You know, got their book sales and everything like that. There's some capitalism going on there.
Right, he's talking about the true faith, religion, people that got the faith. Now, you can say all type of, you're a Muslim, you're a Jew, whatever religion you may have be, but do you have a true giving and the kindness of God in your heart towards humanity? You express this, excuse me.
Yeah, and as for those who say they are Christian, Muslim, Jews, especially the Christian, the things that they must understand is that Messiah Jesus made a clear distinction between God and the capitalists, which he called the, you know, the money changers and all like that. He surrendered the things to God, that's God, the things to Rome, that's Rome. He's talking about the money makers and all that kind of stuff. They practice a communal type of system. They did not practice capitalism. They brought that on later on and attached that to the Messiah Jesus. That's not his doctrine. He didn't deal with that at all. Neither did the prophet Muhammad, neither did Moses. See, they brought all of these concepts on later on. But look, let's talk about what I want to tell about the tents, those living in the tents. Can you give us an idea of the daily routine of the ones living in the tents? What's that like?
Well, when I came here, I know the rules. So I'm kind of like a rule follower. Mm-hmm. And I pitched my tent. I pitched it at CCA at 9 p.m. or sometime a little later. Sometime I pitched it early, depending if it was raining when I was living on the street. Basically, when it rained, I had to worry about the rain getting there. I made sure that I try to carry light things in my tent, my blanket, my sleeping bag. Since this is California, it don't get that cold at night, because I'm from Chicago. So if it get any time down below 40, 50, it still won't bother me. It can get down to 30, won't bother me. But my main concern is living in the tent was night, as people come in there and try to set my tent on fire, try to rob me. Every sound that that come past me, I have to jump up and see what it is. So, excuse me. That was my main concern, living in the tent. But I normally got up before 6. That was my whole routine, to get up and try to do something different to get out of the tent. So I try not to carry food. I utilize my general assistant to feed me. Only time I will probably come down to the mission if I ran out of my food stamps. So
how about logistics? Do you have to be concerned with where you pitch your tent at? Where you?
Yes, the security part about that part. So that's why I felt more comfortable at CCA, which is on 7 in Wishart, putting my tent up, because it was more light and was more people around. More security guards that were walking around would have probably had some sense of decency. If anybody tried to do anything by the hand, they would probably call the police to help me. I chose not to pitch it down on Skid Row for the purpose of what I am, a recovering addict. And I know it was a lot of narcotics down there, and I didn't want to get caught up in that. And I know it's a lot of people that's not trying to do the right thing. And by living in a tent, a lot of things occur, like robbery, or, you know, so forth, fights, tension that bring out by being living in a community of homeless, homelessness, disparity, and mental illness. People do piss tents too, but you never know. They're not taking their medicine or whatever drug they have used to send them all. So this is why I chose that I wanted to be single by myself to pitch a tent, not directly on Skid Row. Not saying I'm better than them, not saying I'm not. I was homeless. It's just I wanted to do better when I got here. So to move up to be homeless was like a stepping stone for me. It taught me and it's still teaching me to appreciate where I'm at right now.
Okay.
And Skid Row housing.
Let's play another clip from a young man that was homeless in the Skid Row area. Hey, this is Melvin Ishmael Johnson with the Coon Ram Report. And I'm out here in the Lafayette Park area across from the library. And I'm going to do an interview. And who am I speaking with here?
Paul.
Paul, can you tell us a little about your background, your home, and how you got out to Los Angeles?
Well, I'm originally from the South Bronx in New York City. And once I lost all my parents and a lot of people in my family, I decided, like, I was on my own. I don't have children. I'm not married. So I said, hey, let me just do something different with my life. So I said, let me come out here. I had a cousin out here, and he helped me get on my feet. And even though he left, and once I got on my feet, And I've been here ever since for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long have you been homeless out here?
Oh, I've been homeless for like almost 2 years now.
What do you think is the biggest challenge out here that a person has to face when you're homeless?
Safety.
Safety?
Yes, because I've never been hungry one day. Because there are so many kind people out here. When they see you homeless, they will look out for you. Mm-hmm. A lot of kind people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't see that until you are in that perspective or in that situation. Then you start seeing how many kind people are out here.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you see a lot of homeless people that come from all over the United States out here?
I've seen a lot of different ethnicities. Mm-hmm. Who come out here. I've met people all the way from Africa who come out here and are homeless.
They're homeless. Do you find many people that live in Los Angeles that are homeless?
Oh, many. The majority. Mm-hmm. The majority. Right in this area, this mm-hmm. whole park mm-hmm. is almost all homeless people. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them come here from Los Angeles. They grew up here.
They grew up in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. A lot of them. And then you have a really kind of a nice, interesting mix of people mm-hmm. here.
How about female? What's the biggest challenge for the females out here that find themselves homeless?
Avoiding to be abused.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the main challenges. Mm-hmm. And one last question. What do you think, what can the city do to improve the conditions of the homeless, to provide more homes for people to live in?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I would think it's just about services, mm-hmm. about services. People need more services and more people coming out to them. Mm-hmm. They're always waiting for people to come to them. They need the services to come out to the people. Mm-hmm. Be on the streets. Hey, oh, you're homeless? Let me help you. Let me look. I get this information. Da, da, da. But they don't do that. We have to always search for them. Mm-hmm. They need to search for us.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. You mean more mobile units that can come out and
right.
really see
what's going on.
Okay, because most people, when they think of the homeless, they just think it's just the Skid Row area.
Yeah.
But it's more than that.
Yeah. There's so many people out here that are so homeless. There's so many people out here. And they've gotten to the point, like, because California's a warm weather state. Mm-hmm. And they've gotten to the point where, like, homelessness has become a part of the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of sad. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sad. People are like, look at this. You see what you see here?
Yeah.
Homelessness has become a lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And you can do it in California. You can mm-hmm. do it and get away with it in California.
Okay, then. Thank you very much. Tell us your name again.
Paul.
Okay, and then remember, Paul, you have an open invitation anytime you want to come. Okay, let's take a break for our community calendar. We'll come back and discuss it a little bit more.
This is the community calendar for upcoming events. This is for all Skid Row poets. There's going to be a Ron Allen Pride Poetry Contest. And this is sponsored by the Los Angeles Poverty Department. And it's going to be held at the Los Angeles Poverty Department Museum at 440 South Broadway. And they're on the second floor downtown Los Angeles. The zip code is 926. There have been two workshops that were already held for the poets to submit their work. One of the workshops was held by Melvin Ishmael Johnson. And another one was held by Carmen Vega. And it was on Friday, May the 8th, and Friday, May the 15th will be the time for the poets to read their poetry. And on Friday, May the 22nd, it's going to be a selection of the work that have been submitted. And the times are 6:30 to 8 p.m. And there's going to be a first place prize of $100. Second place prize of $50, and a third place prize of $25. And I know that all you poets, Skid Row poets, are interested in this. And for more information, please contact the Los Angeles Poverty Department at 213-413-1077 or lapddepartment.org. And the prizes, once again, will be given on the May the 22nd, and there's going to be a party and a celebration on the 22nd. On Wednesday, May the 6th, 2015, from 5:30 p.m., and this is held every Wednesday of the month, we have what we call Tech Talk. and this is for all the Skid Row studio hosts and potential hosts. It's a workshop for engineers and interns, etc., and they come together to discuss ways and means to have high-quality shows here at the Skid Row studio. Also talk about social media, Facebook, Twitter, and much more. The guest speaker this Wednesday will be Nestorius. He has a public radio show here, and he is Nestor Rodriguez. The musical guest will be Willis Boyd, and he has a show here called Positive Perspective. Refreshments will be served. I think on the menu this week we're going to have tacos and something else. Also, Jeremy Hansen, the co-founder of Skid Row Studios, will be on hand to answer questions. And the location of the Tech Talk is the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles 921. For more information on the Tech Talk, please call 213-479-1764 or drumstage1 at yahoo.com. Also, Tuesday, this is May 12th and 13th. This is 2 days. And each May, hundreds of anti-hunger advocates from across the state meet in Sacramento to discuss their legislation about hunger and encouraging their supporters for anti-hunger legislation. Organizations of different kind will go up to Sacramento overnight and rally there. And there's also, if you're interested in going, you need to RSVP, and there will be departure dates. One will be the Los Angeles Can, located downtown. But also, for more information, please contact Frank Tamborello, and his number is 213-388-8228 or frank@hungeractionla.org. Also, we're asking you to save the date, Saturday, May the 16th, 2015 at 6 p.m. Drama Stage Qumran, the Sana Play Reading Series, present a stage play, Catch the Tiger, written by Melvin Ishmael Johnson and directed by Bill White. This play is about J. Edgar Hoover's efforts to bring down black nationalist Marcus Garvey. The location is the United University Church on the campus of USC, 817 West 34th Street, Los Angeles, 989. And this is at the corner of Jefferson and Hoover. This is a free event, free parking, refreshments will be served. After the reading, there will be time for a Q&A. And for more information, please contact 213-479-1764. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com. Attention, Earlene Anthony. And the call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Okay, thank you, Miss Earlene. Anthony, we're back with our in-studio guests, Kamal, Amos, and Aston, and also two of our other guests that's come in, Muwallad Abdul Shaheed and Muhammad Abdullah. Welcome to the Qumran Report. Okay. Let's open up the roundtable and talk about some solutions, what you see as a solutions to what's happening down in the Skid Row area, the homeless in the Skid Row. Astada, what do you...
So, actually, recently, Amos was able to get a video with Officer Dion Joseph, and he outlined a lot of really good points. I'll touch on a couple and then pass it on. His major point was decentralization. There's really almost too many programs right now on Skid Row that offer services. And, you know, there's 88 cities in L.A. County. And of those 88 cities, we have only Long Beach, Santa Monica, and then downtown Los Angeles to really open their doors to the homeless. So, you know, if we could get some of these surrounding cities around downtown L.A. and the Skid Row area to be more accommodating, offer some, you know, low-income housing, some drug programs, some case management programs, then, you know, we could see a lot of the log jam kind of that is Skid Row spread out and go to those other communities and maybe, you know, alleviate some of the pressure that Skid Row faces.
Okay. What do you think, Amos?
Well, like Kamal said, he touched on a lot of ways that you can have a solution. The main thing, I think, you should attack the drugs and the drug dealers. So you run a drug dealer out, now they don't have nowhere to get their drugs. So those that want to get off drugs, they're not going to look for drugs. They're going to look for that solution. Recovering from being a recovering addict is not a destination. It's steady a journey. But you constantly throwing drugs in that person's face and seeing it's so easy to get it. Of course, yes. The solution is to get rid of the drug dealers and offer more programs and teach people how to live again from being from this hopeless state of mind for being homeless, because most people that's on the street is not on drugs. They have mental issues too, I have noticed. Because they're living on the street, that don't mean they on drugs.
But are we talking about the, like what we talked about earlier, I think it's more damage from the legal drug dealers.
Yes, that too.
That prescribes the drugs than it is from anybody selling crack or
and I think just recently Rite Aid down on what is it, Broadway and 7th, they just got busted for giving out too many prescription pills. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are the kinds of things that need to get cleaned up.
That's the capitalism.
Especially in that neighborhood, it's really ridiculous. It's that,
and
that
it
close.
Shut down the one on 5th and Spring too.
Yeah.
Really shut that about 6 months ago. People lost it out there. They weren't happy.
My goodness. Now, what we were talking about earlier is the like of how can the Islamic community get more involved in the Skid Row area? Right now, they have a program called Humanitarian Day. I know Brother Umar runs that out of Damascus, Umar Ibn al-Khatib. And what it is, they run that one day during the Ramadan, but it's a 365, 66-day-a-week problem down there. How can we get the Islamic community more involved in what's happening in the Skid Row community, and also a presence for the brothers who come out of the system and find no vehicle down there to continue to practice their religion?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. By the grace and mercy of Allah, what I would say in regards to the involvement of the Muslim community is to emphasize to the imam of the different masajid, the masjid, the Muslims who are the imam and the emirate must be get involved, as well as those who have been themselves came from that same background. Mm-hmm. Because as the brother spoke about in regards to drugs, when we look at the reality of the political and socioeconomic system of America, it's manifested in oppression. And we have to attack oppression and colonization and neo-colonization, that this is not just something haphazard. This is a reality. And by opening up, if you take, for instance, here in downtown, when I was growing up, went to Metropolitan High School on 7th and Wilson. You have, Belmont High School, Abram Freeman Occupational Center. These facilities of education and vocation need to be opened up to where a person can see their self-worth by education and vocation. In regards also health, what is it that makes a person self-destruct? Is a lack of knowledge of self. Mm-hmm. When you have a lack of knowledge of self, then you internalize that. And the availability of drugs is not haphazard. Like when we read the book Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, the United States government brings in heroin, cocaine. Today, May 4th, Wall Street Journal has an outstanding article on what the brother just said today, and the brothers are pointing out about pharmaceutical drugs. It's that high. And if it's being distributed to the extent where only the pharmacist loses their state license, mm-hmm. but you and I are going to depend. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
And also, let me ask this. I know we talked about it a little earlier, probably one of the most successful drug programs that we ever had in the country. And I consider success is to have over 50% rate. Was the original Nation of Islam substance abuse program that were put in place, where they had over a 90% success rate. And I know there's been a lot of transition in terms of the African-American Muslim, moving away from the nation to Orthodox, where we at now. Why don't we, how did we lose that model? that should be at the forefront of the recovery zone that we have down there in Skid Row right now. How come the brothers in the incident office not pushing that model or something similar down there instead of all of these failed substance abuse models that they have in place down here?
Again, I can only overemphasize mm-hmm. and reiterate is that the brothers who are the imam mm-hmm. is the ones who are not from the ground down.
Mm-hmm.
And through assimilation and acculturation, they are inculcating a substitute culture. Again, mm-hmm. I reiterate, you must have knowledge yourself. Mm-hmm. And if you have brothers and sisters that came, like during the time of the Nation of Islam, from the businessmen, gladiators, Slauson, Bartons, yeah. etc. But then they went through the streets of Hard Rock, as well as Hard Knock. Then those who came out of Tracy, juvenile camps, San Quentin, Folsom. But then they said, well, then I'm not returning to that way of life. And so, therefore, the manifestation is life experience. There is no substitute for experience.
Mm-hmm.
And those who have that knowledge, they must seize the time. And they mm-hmm. must inculcate and institutionalize that by being a part of the people. If you're not a part of the people and a part of the solution, you're part of the problem.
Exactly. And another thing that we discussed a little earlier is that when you look at what's happening in Skid Row, it's about 85% African-Americans. That's land in the tent. You know, what is the obligation of the religious community? All three of them, not just the Christian, but the Christian Muslims and the Jews. How can we, because I look at that as an African-American problem first, you know, in terms of helping our people clam up out of these tents.
Right.
And on Skid Row, when we in the area, we only make up 9% of Los Angeles, but yet and still 85% of people living all up and down the streets in these tents is African American.
Again, like I say, is that by going to prisons and jails and then people coming to actually be involved with the people, if you can't just articulate and be at the member and the pulpit and talk about a problem without going to be actually hands-on with the people. Mm-hmm. And when you see the people and then hear what they have to say, then how can we assist and then to be able to bring about the solution to the problem?
Mm-hmm.
Go get them and make them come because mm-hmm. their scripture tells them, O you who believe, why do you say that which you will not do? Most hateful in the sight of Allah is that which you say you will not do.
Mm-hmm.
So by the grace and mercy of Allah, the last prophet and messenger of Allah, Muhammad ibn Abdullah, peace upon him, said, none of you truly believe till you love for your brother what you love for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have that. They must inculcate that teaching and mm-hmm. not just theoretically espouse it by just saying, okay, I hear and I understand. No, you must practically apply it.
Okay.
Let me catch a little bit of this subject before we get away from it. In regards to the Muslim community working downtown with the homeless community, traditionally it has been a Christian responsibility. I think that the Christian community, I commend them for their work, but I think also they should pave a little bit more of the way and invite the Muslims to work with them. Mm-hmm. I think since the 9/11 situation, mm-hmm. a lot of the Christian community have distanced themselves from the Muslim community, and in response to that, the Muslim community has shied away from coming downtown to work in the area mm-hmm. With the homeless. I think it's a responsibility of the Christian community to open the door of help to the Muslim community and tell them, come on down here and help us. Mm-hmm. We are one spiritual community. Mm-hmm. We all believe in God, and this is all of our work. Mm-hmm. You know, I've assisted some of the brothers out of the community come down here and work with the homeless, and it's shallow on the Muslims' side because it's so large of a Christian community down here working.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to say before we get away from the subject that I believe that if the Christian community didn't distance themselves so much from the Muslim community, I think the Muslims would come in with open arms and assist in the work.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Look, we got 47 seconds. We winding down. So I'd like to extend a special thanks to Kamal Amos Aston from Streetwise L.A., Muwala Abdush Saheed, Muhammad Abdullah, and my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report by Googling in Qumran Report. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report, and from your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with the song that opened the show, Homeboy, by Sunji Ali.
Home. Homeboy. There's only one blood, 'cause it ain't no sense in us trampling on the stones. It's us